Hey, Blenders, it's Sean O'Connell, the managing editor at CinemaBlend and a co-host of the Real Blend podcast with a very special episode for you guys to listen to. Perfect for the Halloween season. It is Robert Englund and Heather Langenkamp talking about the original A Nightmare on Elm Street. If you had told teenage me that this is ever going to happen, I would not have believed you, obviously. Nightmare on Elm Street by director Wes Craven, seminal horror film. For me and countless others who I'm sure are getting a chance to listen to this, coming up on the 40th anniversary of Nightmare on Elm Street. And because of that, our friends at Warner Brothers and New Line Cinema were doing a press day, and they offered us Freddy and Nancy combined. And how do you not take that? But what's incredible about this interview, to me at least, is that I heard stories from each of them that I'd never heard before. And sometimes it took a little detouring into the rest of the franchise, which is great. But I always kind of wanted to hear from Heather Langenkamp, who had originated Nancy in the first movie, like why she didn't come back for the second one. How come that movie went in a different direction, bringing her then back for Dream Warriors in part three? So they have some great stories to tell, not just about the original film, but about the immediate sequels that followed after it. It's also fun, I think, because if you were listening to the show and you heard most recently where we got to do that horror icons sort of bracket competition, and through all of our candid sort of honest answers, Robert Englund's Freddy Krueger came at the top of that list. And so to be able to have him on the show to talk about his creation is truly, truly incredible. Great, great stories from these two. Just seeing them together gives me goosebumps, honestly, like just chills seeing these two legends of this iconic property together. So without further ado, on behalf of the Halloween season and Real Blend having some fun for October, this is Robert Englund and Heather Langenkamp talking about A Nightmare on Elm Street on behalf of the film's 40th anniversary.
I spoke with a few years ago Kane Hodder, who obviously played Jason in several Friday movies, and he told me that he used to keep a distance from a lot of the kids on set so that their scenes would be more intimidating. But I always think back, there's a great photo of you guys on set together. Robert, I think you even have like headphones on and you're all sort of hanging out together. I'm sort of curious.
John, that's Johnny Depp's Walkman.
Is that Johnny Depp's Walkman?
But can you seriously imagine this guy like not wanting to be the center of the party? I mean, whenever there was more than three people gathered, Robert was usually at the center, because we were so young, we had never had the chance to, you know, live the life that Robert had with so much experience and so many great stars and great directors, that we really used it as, you know, informal acting school / film school.
It's also a trust thing.
Yes.
If I know you guys, then I can say something like, Heather, the light's not in your eye, you know, on the set. Or I can say, Heather, it'll help me if you move over this way a little bit.
Yeah.
And we just cut to the chase. You know, we don't have to pretend to do an acting exercise to get to the truth of that moment. I can say, Heather, it would really help me if you'd lean on your left leg here, because I've got to follow through on this grab.
Yeah.
And I would do the same thing with the other kids, too. So you can just get to that point of intimacy with each other and trust.
I think the movie really shows it, too, because our scenes are very intimate. I mean, we're really close to each other all the time. And Robert, like I said, he just had so many great pieces of advice. I remember teaching Johnny Depp one thing, and it was to always tell the sound man if you were going to scream loudly, because their earphones, you know, they have to be able to turn down the volume. And I got a nice tongue lashing one time from a sound man because I had screamed, you know, Scream Queen. But I hadn't told him that I was going to be using full volume. And so I told Johnny Depp, like, make sure you tell the sound man that you're going to scream loudly. But Robert was always offering us, like, lots of tips about, you know, how to use your body on the set that I do think really shows. I think the movie is it's well acted because Robert was there to help us.
Well, I had had great advice years before, arguably one of the greatest actors in the history of film, Henry Fonda, had told me, he said, you know, sometimes it's better to be at 70% and have the light in your eye than to be at 100% and to be off your mark in the dark. And he also said, and he also told me there was a time and a place to use the stuff that makes the tears, because he said, if you are organically crying, he said, which is what is truthful and what you want to do, he goes, but they do more than one take. He said, by the third take, your eyes will be pink and swollen. The audience is going to know you're going to cry. Mm. And that's why Hollywood makeup men have always had that little thing they blow in your eye to make you tear, because that doesn't make your eyes swell up and get red from actual crying. Then you're not foreshadowing that you're going to cry. Oh, you're going to get some crying here. Look at my puffy eye. You're going to get some crying here later in the scene. That's why sometimes it has to be artificial, because you'll tip what's coming if not.
That's a great point.
Guys, I'm glad you're referencing all these lessons and tips that you were giving each other on the set, because I think that this film, it gets studied by up-and-coming filmmakers, aspiring filmmakers, especially those who want to get into the horror genre. They'll go back to the roots of a movie like this to kind of see how Wes Craven did it. But, of course, they'll never get to intimately know the man the way that you two both did. What is something that you would share, Heather? What is something you'd share about Wes specifically that would maybe help an aspiring filmmaker better understand the kind of storyteller he was?
Well, he was a very, intelligent man, so he didn't have any fears about, giving you a lot of, good ideas about how to approach the role and what he's thinking about when he was writing it. But what I found the most valuable that Wes Craven did is, because I was, 18 years old, incredibly, all 18-year-old women at that time, in your life you feel insecure, you don't know if you're doing a good job, you don't have a chance to really judge against anything else you've ever seen before. And Wes had no problem pulling you aside and telling me that he thought I was doing a good job. And what that did for me is that I went forward feeling like, okay, I don't have to think about what I just did. I can now go to the next scene and prepare. And I know that I've pleased the director, and I know that I'm not wondering like, oh, did he like it? Did he not like it? Which is a kind of thought you do not want to have in your head when you're trying to act at all. To be worried about whether you're, making the grade and you're, basically doing your job well. And I feel like a lot of people don't have that relationship with their actors, or they don't feel like giving them compliments helps anything. But for me and Wes, I really not only treasured it, but I just felt like such a warmth and appreciation from him that I think shows in the movie.
Yeah, he was a double threat. He was a writer first, and then a director, which means he can solve a lot more on his feet in the moment. And that was wonderful, that you could surrender a little more to Wes, because you knew he could fix it if a line wasn't fitting in your mouth or something was seemed strange in the scene. He was very open to that. He ran a very open set. It was a very democratic set. He had a kind of a wonderful – he preserved the 14-year-old boy in him, and he was crack wise.
Yeah, there are a lot of goofy moments.
A lot of jokes. I don't think, and I mean this absolutely sincerely, I don't think I ever saw him yell or be in a bad mood on the set. And I starred in 3 movies for him and 6 hours of television, and in all that time, I never saw him raise his voice.
Incredible. Thank you.
Going back to what you were saying about the tears and the 70% is kind of be more effective, that idea of less is more. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think you're only in A Nightmare on Elm Street for about less than 10 minutes. Freddy's actually on screen, I think, for less than 10 minutes or so, which I think is wild to me. And
there
think
are
about...
no small monsters, only small actors.
The reason I bring that up is because you think about the iconic elements in cinema history, Jaws, that less shark is more because you don't see him. It's more scary. Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, I think he's on screen for less than 20 minutes. You feel the presence of these characters even when they're not on the screen, and that's a testament to what you do on the screen that leaves that presence when you're not there in those moments. So for each of you, can you talk about that idea of less is more in terms of Freddy's presence and why we feel his presence even when he's not there, and for both of your perspectives?
A lot of that's structural, let's be honest. I mean, it's structured that way, and so is Silence of the Lambs. It's structured that way, and Jaws as well. And that's, that's a part and parcel of cinema shaping, of screenplays and storytelling and narrative. So that's something that audiences hook on. They will hook on that and on anything. And it was just exploited very successfully, I think, by Wes in the original. what had happened was audiences became so engaged with this evil character that they wanted more of him. They wanted more of his sense of humor and more of his personality, because even in the original, there's a sense of humor and personality with Freddy. And that's the difference between Michael Myers and Jason and so many others. There is no personality there. Freddy is sort of kind of likes his work.
He
kind of likes this work of revenge. Yeah.
But I do also think that Wes, he was really concerned that the audience related to the main teenagers, that it was their, people's sympathy for their plight and their, you know, difficulty sleeping, and creating that reality is actually really tough because, you know, none of us have ever experienced that. So, you know, all the storytelling that it took to create that heightened tension in Nancy's life, Glenn's life, Rod, Tina, like that, by the time that gets amped up enough so that you actually are afraid of Freddy, it just, it takes a lot of storytelling.
But it also, it's primal. Lack of sleep.
Yes.
Lack of sleep. You can't sleep. Don't sleep. Never sleep again. Because if you do, all hell's going to break
loose. The grown-ups don't believe you.
But everybody can identify with it. Yeah. So the give there, the happy get there, is that the audience cathartically can identify with that, because it's a primal thing. Sleep. It's like the nightmare of suffocating or drowning or falling or flying. But also the idea that someone could violate your subconscious, and if you sleep, you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
Genius. Robert, as a quick follow up to that, because you talk about how Freddy likes his work, and you don't get that in the Michael Myers, you don't get that in Jason. I am seeing that a bit now in this new franchise, Terrifier, with Art the Clown, and that character seems to like his work, and he's kind of goofy in a way, kind of like Freddy in some sense. Have you seen those films, and what do you think that Art the Clown's kind of built his way into that horror legacy now?
I've seen the first one, and the films are incredibly popular. You know, I've seen the first one. I like it. I like where it's going, you know, but it's I don't equate them, because I think Freddy's is a different revenge. You know, the two wrongs don't make a right. Mm-hmm. Freddy is a child killer. There is nothing more horrific on earth. And for whatever reasons that he was, you know, you blame his daddy or his mommy, it doesn't matter. It's a horrible thing to be. But he was also burned alive. And my theory is he's never quite made it to hell. He's in some suspended purgatory where, if you think about him, and then you know about him, then you dream about him, and he can access it from his particular purgatory. He can access you on a revenge motif. And he wants that. He needs that. It's almost like he's trying to earn his way to hell. You know, he's not quite there yet, but he'd rather be there than this thing, and he has to, so he enjoys his work.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
Guys, I've got to tell you, one of my favorite movie experiences ever was whenever I was a kid and Nightmare was my favorite movie, going to see Scream on opening weekend and having a character say, Nightmare on Elm Street is my favorite scary movie, and thinking, hey, me too. Yeah. And then she's killed.
Yeah.
You know, Wes paid so many tributes to Nightmare and Scream, obviously with Drew Barrymore. And then at one point he is dressed as the janitor named Fred with the wearing the sweater. I'm sort of curious, when do you guys remember hearing that was going to be a thing? Was it after the movie came out? Did he say, hey, I'm going to throw some Easter eggs in there? How did you guys become aware of that?
I was having dinner on Melrose in a trendy new restaurant, and I looked over, and there was Mariana Magdalena, Wes Craven, and Drew Barrymore in her little short bob. I used to babysit Drew Barrymore when she was a child, I knew her mother. I had an actress friend who was best friends with her mother, and so I knew that. And I hadn't seen Drew since a screening of one of her movies, Poison Ivy or something. And so I just went by the table on the way out to give a hug to Marianne and a hug to Wes and to Drew. And I made a joke. I just said, you know, got to use her. You know, I didn't know about Scream. I just meant they were obviously taking a meeting and I use it. You know, she's great. And she and Drew got up and gave me a little hug and that was it. But yeah, I kind of knew they were going to play with it. I heard that. And, you know, thank goodness, because the success of Scream 1 sent audiences back to reevaluate Wes Craven's New Nightmare, Part 7. And with what was easy for them to understand about the meta deconstructed nature of the Scream movies, movies about us, the viewer, with us, the viewer, in them. We know what you know, and we know that you know that we know how you do this stuff, all the tropes and everything. They went back to see Wes's Nightmare 7, and we became, by the time we were out on DVD, we became huge because the Scream movie had taught people how to see Nightmare 7.
And I often wonder, you know, Kevin Williamson's script, I'd never read the original script, but how much of that was part of the original script? Obviously, Wes was attracted to it and that he agreed to direct that film. I think that was a really lucky circumstance for the Scream people because Wes did bring, already he'd worked out these meta tropes that he'd already made a full movie, you know, about. And so I always thought the luck of that pairing was just so fortuitous for Wes and for, you know, Kevin Williamson, that they loved each other and were able to bring that movie to life.
Heather, going back to that time when the first movie comes out, you know, nowadays you lock up an actor for three movies in a row. You know, they're part of a franchise. Were there conversations to bring you back for Nightmare 2? I looked around to find any kind of information
about
you being involved.
I mean, the idea of the sequel was like even so brand new back in 1984 they never even discussed the idea that another movie might be made because of the way we were shooting so many different endings to the script, that Bob Shea was asking us to do this ending and then that ending and that maybe Freddy's alive and then maybe, you know, he's not. And so that cued me in. But no, they always thought that the house on Elm Street was going to be kind of the nexus of Freddy's power, and the place where he existed was in that, 1428 Elm Street. And that was the place where Freddy was going to haunt the children, and they would just slide in and out of that house. And I think that was their original idea. But eventually, well, because Wes Craven did have a chance to write the third movie, he really thought that Nancy and Freddy were the, you know, kind of the main attractions that needed to be brought back and have that be the story that he wanted to tell.
And I'm not unsure that they might have been working on Dream Warriors earlier than we think. They did part two because they had that script. I'm not sure, but they may have had that script. And Jack Shoulder, who knew Wes and had edited for Wes before, and the New Line people, that they maybe wanted to do two while they were still developing three, because they obviously, simultaneous to the making of two and the writing of two and getting two out into theaters, part one is still breaking box office records in Tokyo and in Sydney, Australia, you know, and in Helsinki. And they could see that. New Line could see, whoa, we have a huge international hit. We got to do another one with Heather, you know. And they may have known that at some point during the development of two and started to develop three for Heather. They needed the time.
But also
they wanted to get two out there. Yeah.
I think the relationship between Bob Shea and Wes also, you know, was probably what I've heard. You know, there was some trouble. So that had to be repaired and smoothed over as well before Wes wrote that script. But, you know, he was not invited to direct that script, which was very interesting to me at the time, because it's really hard to act a Wes Craven script without Wes Craven there because, you know, he has so much to add to what he's written. You know,
let me say something about Dream Warriors. Heather sponsored a wonderful charity at the old Whiskey A Go-Go on Sunset Boulevard a couple of years ago. And we all showed up, the cast, to read it. And I should have volunteered to read the in-between dialogue segments. Chuck Russell got to do that. Freddie only has three or four lines in the whole damn movie. But
But
we're all there. And what Heather had found was the original first draft of Dream Warriors. And it's an Oscar-winning list of screenwriters and Wes. But right. The between the dialogue writing is like reading a Stephen King. It's really? Dark and wonderful. So if you ever see a copy of that first draft, Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3, Dream Warriors, it's just great to have one in your collection. It's that good. And I would love someday again to do a charity and read it. This time I'd like to read it or read it out loud on a radio show or something.
And we raised money for the D.D. Hirsch suicide prevention organization, which because of the themes of Nightmare 3 seemed like the perfect place to donate the money.
But that
Robert for showing up. Well, we were really
But that script, that script, that Nightmare 3 script is a great script. And when you look at the writers who contributed to it, it's they're all-star Hollywood writers.
Jake ask that again. Is the line
was the welcome to primetime line in the original script?
Yeah.
Well, it's now you're in the bit. It is after we shot it. They put it back, but now you're in the big time, Jennifer. Now you made the big time, Jennifer. Or you're in the big time now, Jennifer. It didn't quite fit. And welcome to prime time was my improv. So they put them both in there. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. But what about actually on the set, Robert did often improvise three or four different taglines, like especially with Taryn when she gets killed with the hypodermic needles. I remember you tried several different lines on that one.
Well, oh my God, those gaping holes in her arm are one of the most terrifying
images. The sucking holes.
We also ended sequences very dark and sometimes with a one-liner, a Freddy wisecrack.
Yeah.
And I think that the editors, perhaps, and the producers and the time frame on some of these movies, it made it easier for them to end with a kind of rim shot, but a bump of a joke or a Freddy laugh or a Freddy make my day line like Clint Eastwood to kind of give it punctuation, scenic editorial punctuation. I wish, going back, we had relied a couple of times on some of the darker takes. I know I had a darker take with Kincaid in that's part four, I believe. Mm. I had a much darker ending to that sequence than we did, almost a Godfather kiss of death thing. They didn't use that. And then there was a couple of others that I just think it would have been better to. It would have kept Freddy a little darker, a little longer.
Gotcha. Wow. Well, we're out of time, guys. I really wish we could have talked to you all day, but we really appreciate you coming on the Real Blend Podcast. Congratulations on your incredible careers.
Thank
you so much, guys.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Thank you so much to our good friends at Warner Brothers. Make sure you guys check out the different copies of A Nightmare on Elm Street now that it's celebrating its 40th anniversary. You can also now, I have seen, the film is back on Max. You can check it out that way as well, too. Never a bad time to check out the Nightmare films. All of the sequels still really great for their different reasons. But you go back and rewatch that first one and you see what Wes Craven was doing. To have an antagonist that haunts your dreams and you're not able to go to sleep or else you'll be threatened by him is still one of the most terrifying concepts. And I'm really glad that Freddy won our bracket. Reasons to keep it on Real Blend, in addition to fun episodes like this one and previous interviews that we've had, we do have a really great one coming up on Friday. We have John Crowley and star Andrew Garfield coming on the show to talk about their upcoming film, We Live in Time, which is available in a few markets. I think it's rolling out larger on Friday. You're going to be able to see it in more theaters. Really, really great film between Andrew Garfield and Florence Pugh, who have already been generating headlines for the amount of chemistry that the two of them have. great to get to have Andrew on the show. Obviously, you guys know personally how much I adore Andrew and what he means to me as my favorite Spider-Man. So it was great to be able to talk to him about that film franchise. It's an episode you're going to want to listen to here on Real Blend. So if you're watching on the YouTube channel, hit subscribe, turn on your notifications, you'll be alerted the moment that a new episode drops. And in the meantime, thanks so much for checking out Real Blend. We'll talk to you guys soon with a brand new episode.